the Emmy Louie Show. I am Emmy Louie. Today's topic is about biodynamic farming. Our guest speaker, our guest is Charles Beatty. He's the executive director of the Biodynamic Farming and Gardening Association, headquartered in Oregon of the United States. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Thank you for being on the show. So tell me, what is biodynamics?
Well, a group of farmers and individuals, veterinarians, approached, and we're talking about now in the 1920s, actually approached a fellow named Rudolf Steiner because as farmers in Middle Europe, they were even at that time recognizing a deterioration in the keeping quality of their vegetables, the fertility of their animals, the germination quality of their seeds. And they approached Steiner and asked for indications about what they could do to remedy this situation. And it got to a point, because Steiner was such a busy man at that time, that they Count Kaiserlinck is the fellow's name where this took place. And he sent his nephew to Steiner's doorstep and said, don't come home until he agrees. And so finally, in June of 1924, about 9 months before Steiner died, in fact, he went to Count Kaiserlinck's estate in what was Eastern Germany and gave a series of lectures and indications on agriculture, which have now become known as biodynamic agriculture. So that's sort of the setting, and the actual then practices that came out of those indications have been employed by people around the world. Because it is an agriculture which really attempts to relate the ecology of the earth to that of the wider cosmos, in a nutshell.
Why should we care, and is there an increase of the popularity right now? Because organic foods is all the rage. At one time it was not that popular, but now it's rather almost mainstream. And what do you see as the pattern? What's going on? Because a lot of the organic farming seems like it's just returning to what it was before. What are your thoughts about that? How does this all fit in?
Well, it fits in, and I would relate that because the largest organic trade show in Europe takes place in Germany in February of every year. And it attracts probably 1,600 different booths, you know, and endeavors from around Europe, and in fact around the world. And in their English language edition, they list Rudolf Steiner as being the grandfather of the organic movement because of his lectures on biodynamics. And for a long time, I was really mystified by that, you know. And so what this really states, and this is part of what, you know, will lead us into the, you know, part of our conversation about biodynamics, is that there was a fellow who studied with Rudolf Steiner named Aaron Fried Pfeiffer, who brought biodynamics into North America during the 1930s. And he was actually living in a little town called Kimberton in Pennsylvania. And there was another fellow that he knew as well, and this is like we're talking about 1940. And so this other fellow's name was J.I. Rodale. And the biodynamic journal began, because we produce a quarterly journal on biodynamics. In fact, it's called Biodynamics, and it has been in continuous publication since 1940. And Organic Gardening and Farming magazine began in 1941. And J.I. Rodale and Aaron Fried Pfeiffer knew each other. I don't know how well. I wasn't there. But they were acquainted. And so what you had was that, in a way, biodynamics is a wider sense of organic agriculture in the way that it does not use chemicals or pesticides or herbicides on the farm, but it also attempts to take into account the widest possible influences on agriculture and make them sort of effective in the production of foodstuffs for humanity, essentially. So we are finding, and I think this is as well a sign of our times, that people really have, it seems to me, a longing inside of themselves for something a bit more than just the physical nature that we see around us. And in some ways, and I'm not disparaging at all about organic agriculture, because its increasing popularity is a tremendously a good thing for both humans and the earth. But we need to take into account a bit wider influences in agriculture. And so this is what Rudolf Steiner attempted to bring, and what organic and biodynamic agriculture are certainly bringing into our world, too.
When you say wider influences, give me an example. What does that mean? Well, I mean, what is a specific example when you say wider influences?
Modern influences? I mean, if we look at agriculture, we could really get back to what could be termed the importance in agriculture of proper manuring. And so in today's world...
Manuring?
Manuring. I know,
well,
it's so
it's
hard
both.
To get really
You're
back to basics.
Over the manure. Okay.
But it's...
Oh, we get right into it, huh?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. We can, you know, this is going to probably be this today, you know, an introduction to many different aspects. Because if we would take one step back from that...
That's okay. You can just go right into it.
Oh, yeah.
Don't worry about it.
Well, one of the basic ideas that Steiner really brought, which is very actually modern in its extreme, perhaps, and that is the farm as being a living organism, and that farm with the potentiality of really becoming an individuality. And so in looking at the farm in that manner when we look at the farm in its essential nature, in the best sense of the word, if it can be conceived of as an individual entity in itself, a self-contained individuality. And so in that way, what we have in modern life is that how could you possibly perceive or conceive of that? And the way that he brought was that we must begin to look at the human being and see not only its relationship to the farm, but how the farm itself as an individuality, because what does that mean? And we look at the human being, and we see how the human being is organized, and using that then as a reflection then to see how we can in fact organize our farming. So it's really in part answer to your question of if biodynamics can become as popular as organic. I would hope so in the future, but one of its basic requirements and what it really appears to be is a path of knowledge that therefore requires a lot of inner work by the farmer. And so in that sense, because of that personal, individual nature, people come to biodynamics really on an individual level. And so the practice of it is such that it's not just simply taking the same image of, say, commercial agriculture and simply not using chemicals on the same sort of economic or physical paradigm, but rather to, you know, view the farm as this living organism, which is a development in itself in the same way that we like to view ourselves individually as a creature, you know, that can develop and that we can grow into the future.
So what happened then with the mainstream agribusiness? What happened? Did it start a long time ago? When did it start to diverge? Or
well, it really, you know, and once again, if we look at the human and human history and the history of the earth, we find that in a way, if we reach back in time, you can see the sort of spiritual aspects that people were able to experience, say, through the Persian culture into the Egyptian culture and into, you know, the Greek and Roman and coming up to our times. It seemed as though that the spiritual aspects, and we can call these spirits or forces or hidden natures or some other, you know, really the unseen part of our lives. And we can see that as being really more active, you know, in the lives of human beings. But one of the, at least according to Steiner, one of the tasks of our times is to become really individual, you know, to become these independent individual people. And that is an immediate contrast then, this polarity, becoming an individual person and also community life. So it seems as though that wisdom of the past really had to be, in a way, lost to a certain extent, so that this individuality of the human could really make itself known and experienced. And now, again, according to Steiner, our task is really to combine that, to really re-achieve that wisdom of the past without returning to the past. And really achieving that wisdom in clear intellectual content. So what happened is when those sort of apron strings, perhaps, in the spiritual world were cut on humanity, humanity began to see, and let's go back to manuring, especially the cow's manure, that we really felt as a human beings, and this is in the late 1800s and into the 20th century, that it was possible to, say, take the cow's manure, find out what the substances were in that, and then replace the cow's manure with these artificial mineral fertilizers. And so we have really lost the wisdom of what the cow is, and it can be represented in the culture of India and the sacredness of the animal. And we have attempted to replace this with this sort of chemical approach to fertilizing. And this is why I come back to manuring. I'm sorry if it's going to sit center stage here. It won't be smelly, I hope. But we've sort of lost that perception and ability to understand, like, the qualities of the different kingdoms of nature. And so in our agriculture today, since we have, in a way, lost that at least perceived connection to the spiritual world, we now have an agriculture which is essentially one of privatized profits and socialized costs. So we think, you know, because the human is a really clever intellectual being, and we can apply these forces of nature to sort of one thing at a time. So consequently, we have these now monocultures. We have sort of an endless production of wheat or chickens or pigs or cows, instead of having any sort of relationship to a wider measure of, you know, sort of what we're all really doing here on Earth. And the loss of that measure means that really we just proceed in a way and trying to survive as individual people. So we cut down our forests, we have pollution in our water tables, we have loss of topsoil in our farming, and because we've really lost a measure, that helps to guide our actions.
Okay, so we're here with Charles Beattie, Executive Director of the Biodynamic Farming and Garden Association. We'll be back and we'll talk more about biodynamics. I'm Emmy Louie, and we'll be back. Welcome back. I'm Emmy Louie. And so we're here with Charles Beattie. He's the Executive Director of the Biodynamic Farming and Garden Association. And so, Charles Beattie, is this organization representing a lot of the farming companies across the nation? What is this? Is this a nonprofit?
Yes, so the Biodynamic Association is a 501c3, which is an educational nonprofit. And it was incorporated in North America, amazingly enough, in 1938. So it really predates organic agriculture by a few decades. And it is made up of approximately 1,000 members nationwide. It is related to other biodynamic associations that exist on all other continents. And there is a center for biodynamics situated in Switzerland, where we can go back to as well. And it is, but we service beyond the members, we service a lot of different people in a lot of different situations. And one of the interesting, when we talk about land use and such, is that a movement which is now in North America, which you may have heard of, is called community-supported agriculture. And these various, I think they're probably over, it began in the mid-1980s, and it is now, there's approximately 1,500 of these community-supported agricultural projects or, you know, initiatives. And what it is that people actually, you know, will come and they buy a share in this community-supported agricultural project and then receive a portion of the actual harvest and the bounty from that farm or garden over the course of a year. And so what that is, it wasn't meant only to be a way for farmers to, you know, gain a better economic foothold, but rather it was meant to reconnect people with the land. And that is one of the basic tenets of biodynamics, is that people still, and particularly in our world, need to reconnect with a physical, concrete part of the land. So biodynamics views actually the entire earth as a living organism, and therefore one which is in a development process itself. And so the human being, it also views the human as being part of that process from the very beginning as well. So the human development and the earth development follow along together, and also this development, then, and that is why we use the image of the human being in our observation of the land and the farm itself. So therefore, if we perceive this farm as being a living organism, then it needs to be treated in such a way that that being will be alive for future generations as well. And the food that comes off of that land will be food that will really contain within itself the qualities that will be necessary for humanity as a whole and individuals as well to actually have a positive future development.
Charles Beattie, that was very eloquent.
Oh, thank you.
I'm very happy that I'm interviewing you and that you are representing such an extraordinary organization. And I had a few thoughts just to emphasize what you just said. It sounds that it's about reconnecting with the land, and there has to be a physical reconnection. And there are some thoughts that I thought about while you were saying that, and it has to do with gardening and the great feeling of just gardening and manipulating with your hands and touching the earth. And that's a very simple form of just being physically in contact with the land. And I wanted to go one step further, is that I wanted to know if there is a requirement or a high emphasis on working on the farm or being part of the farm when you're part of this community-supported agriculture. Is there a requirement to harvest or help out? And also, when you say that, the participation, this kind of participation, physical participation, is that, I would think, is just as important as volunteering or giving to charity or tithing. And these things we think of as not frivolous or what am I saying? Because these are all, they're voluntary acts. Working on the farm, volunteering, tithing, they're voluntary acts. But in point of fact, they're very, very important for the human spirit, even though it's voluntary, because the thing is that we want to do it voluntarily. We don't want to be forced, because then it would be kind of with an oxymoron. And I think I talked about this in one of the shows where we were forced to volunteer, which is kind of an oxymoron. What are your thoughts about what I said, Charles Beatty?
Oh, well, you hit it right on the head, too, because this is why it can be very serendipity today, because we're really facing, you know, what can be seen as a turning point in time in human evolution. And that is because either we can continue to go down, you know, the road and, you know, once again, we don't want to say, oh, we're so much better than them. You know, we don't want to make ourselves tall by cutting off other people's heads, but rather to try and grow into the future. But we can see when we look around us, you know, the problems in society, the problems in the land, the problems. And when Ehrenfried Pfeiffer asked Steiner, he said, why do people, you know, who are involved in good spiritual endeavors, you know, and this is 1920 again, you know, why do they show so little outward manifestation of this? And Steiner gave the incredible reply that it was a matter of nutrition, that the foods that people were eating, and once again, I don't think our nutrition is better 85 years down the road, that, you know, that the foods that people were eating did not contain the forces necessary to connect their heads with their hands. And that is one of our problems, is that we can come up, you know, so we've had the wisdom in a way in the way distant past, you know, without the intellect, and now we seem to arrive at a point where we have the intellect. We can make up all these crazy, you know, things about how the world works, you know, and so what we need to do is combine those two. And what helps people to combine those two, and especially our children, is to eat foods that have been properly nourished or manured, and to have that supply these types of forces. And to give an example, that in the modern world of chemical agriculture, we have water-soluble fertilizers. And so if a plant is thirsty, it has to take up these chemicals whether it needs them or would want them or not. It doesn't have a choice. And this is where the freedom you were just talking about. What biodynamics does is to observe the soil as a living organism, and out of that awareness, then to nourish the soil so that the plant can, in fact, seek out from this living soil what it needs in order to form these proper plant proteins, which can then feed the animal appropriately and can feed the human appropriately. And so it is, you know, people need to, if they can do it from the window boxes on their apartment in New York City, or, you know, we've talked about biodynamics from the inside out, not only eating the food, but how do you treat your house plants, how do you treat your yard and your garden and your farm and your state, and the appropriateness of certain agricultural practices on certain land. And it goes on from there, but it's not just to, like, feed people. It's rather to say, you know, how do we, as humanity, how are we actually going to go forward into the future? And especially looking at our children. So, I mean, Steiner, I don't know if you're familiar with the Waldorf schools, mm-hmm. but that comes out of the same spiritual and philosophical wellspring that biodynamic agriculture does. So he had a lot to say about, you know, the proper education of children, and my children go to Waldorf schools, and so forth. So it takes us into the social aspect, the treatment of the land, but also the treatment of the human being, the treatment of the plant, the treatment of the animal. So these huge feedlots or thousands of chickens, and I mean, we must see that that's not going to nourish us into the future. So it is important for individuals to, in some manner, reconnect themselves with agriculture and the land.
Sounds good to me. So we'll be back, and I'm going to ask Charles more about how we're going to, what his vision of biodynamic farming. I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to the Emmy Louie Show, and the biodynamics website is http://biodynamics.com. So we'll be back. And my website is www.emyloue.com, and you can listen to the archives there. And we're here with Charles Beatty, and we're talking about biodynamic farming. Charles Beatty is Executive Director of the Biodynamic Farming and Garden Association, headquartered in Oregon. And during the break, I asked Charles what is his vision, what is his utopia of his vision of utopia and how biodynamic farming fits in. And I understand what you just said, Charles, is that biodynamic farming is making strides in production of wine. So, Charles Beatty, what is the strides being made with the production of wine?
Well, it's very interesting that when you go into a grocery store, to buy your produce, let's say I will do this.
Yes, sure.
I will go straight to the organic section, and that's where I will buy my produce. But what I've discovered is that people don't buy wine that way. And so if you look at the vocabulary of wine and the tasting of wine and the actual expense of wine, you realize that people are relying on some other sort of perception of quality that guides them to their choices. And what is very interesting is that in most of the major wine publications today, Wine Spectator, Wine Advocate, Wine and Spirits, Food and Wine, all of them are saying, what's this biodynamic? Because Robert Parker said, well, I don't know anything about the philosophy, but I do know that in every blind test tasting that biodynamic wines come out on top. And his favorite winemaker in Burgundy is Lalou Bizet, and she's a biodynamic wine grower. In California, to bring it closer to our shores, very many of the wine people in Northern California and here in Oregon and in Washington are beginning to turn to biodynamics. It's a ecologically sound way of farming, and what it does, because wineries, they talk about terroir, the actual truth of place. And that's what biodynamics seems to bring out, both in wines and in food, is that it brings out the best essential character of the place and the type of wine that is being produced. Now, it may be that your site, your vineyard, isn't suited to some of the things that you're growing, so it might bring out the best character of your site, but it may not be the best wine. So that's also a truth. But that people have this perception of quality, and they appear more and more to be guided towards biodynamic and its methods in agriculture. And a friend of mine who is a consultant in Northern California is now working as well in Tuscany in Italy, and he is sort of helping, it's more than one vineyard, go towards biodynamics. And the person who actually owns this property is the musician Sting. And so other people who are really, and I said, well, Alan, I said, why does somebody like Sting, why would he go for biodynamics? And so Alan said, well, he said, you know, almost every major wine connoisseur in the world knows about biodynamics, and it is perceived to be of high quality. Now, it's really great because Nicolas Joly is one of these fellows who I've taken around as a speaker. speaker on biodynamics out of France, too. And what he does, though, he always has me bring food to these workshops that we do, because he said, this is what you like to drink, but this is what you need to eat. So it's really amazing that it is this world of wine that is propelling at least the name biodynamic into the marketplace. And therein lies the challenge for me personally and for the organization and other people involved in biodynamics, is to have that same sort of perception of quality be evident in the foods that people eat too.
Because right now, and let me go back to just food and your view on how the utopia ideal situation of biodynamics is, what happens to the paradigm of the supermarket? What if I wanted to go to a supermarket, which I do now? How would that change? What do you see?
Well, what we're finding is there's, in utopia, I mean, it's just hard to have this image of sort of what 6 to 8 billion people shopping in your corner supermarket, you know, your corner stores. So, I mean, ideally, people can have. So, what we're doing with the CSAs now is trying to widen that model, and not just have individuals, but also then take into account other aspects. So, in Europe, what is happening is that. I just spoke with a fellow who, this is what's happening. He has a biodynamic CSA and farm. He has a biodynamic restaurant in one of these beautiful villages in Switzerland. And that beautiful biodynamic restaurant serving biodynamic foods and biodynamic wines resides in a hotel. And now, because more products from Egypt and elsewhere are being produced biodynamically, the people are also then sleeping on biodynamic sheets, you know, made out of biodynamic cotton. And now they're saying, well, if you have a forester using biodynamic methods, maybe we can come out and have biodynamic furniture. So people are actually looking at widening the scope and the impact that can happen through agriculture that would impact people's lives. So children can go to, and I'm not saying it has to be just biodynamic, but if we have a consciousness about what we're doing and what we hope for, that this will really guide then an education of children, because you don't want them just to succeed economically, but rather you want them to be a whole person. And to actually, if there is, and I believe there is, a truth and reality and reincarnation, then we also bring tasks with us when we come into this world. And those tasks we really need to be able to get on with and do and accomplish, so that we can progress both individually and as a society. So my utopia would be that we would really have agriculture to such an extent that it would make possible for people to be properly fed, and through that proper nutrition, be able to realize really their tasks on the earth.
So, in a lot of ways, you're almost saying something that even our grandparents haven't experienced. Is that correct?
Well, the model that we've gotten away, and once again, biodynamics and this conversation is not at all meant to go back to some Victorian utopia at all, which actually didn't exist at that time either.
Yeah.
But it is to find ways into the future. Now, perhaps that could still have a supermarket, but perhaps certain things like produce. Produce probably should be consumed on a more local level, something like a coffee, which there is biodynamic coffees out there as well, can be shipped a further way. A friend of mine has a wonderful biodynamic farm in Montana, one of our past presidents, Lifeline Farm, and he ships cheeses throughout North America as well. So it is possible to ship, because and our current president has a 1,300-member CSA. He raises probably 300 acres of vegetables, and he delivers twice a week into New York City. So we're not saying that those people in New York City must come out to the farm, although that would be wonderful. But we are saying that the nutrition of that farm can be found in New York City. So I think it would be more trying to meet people halfway, that in fact the supermarket will exist certainly as long as I live. And people will, because of the way our society is set up now, we have to be realistic in that sense too, that no, I cannot see at this moment going back to the corner store. And so we have to find a way to penetrate in a rightful way into those other markets. And way back probably 10 years ago now, even Whole Foods, who are the people who founded Whole Foods are certainly well aware of Biodynamics as well, that on their list, you know, on the chalkboard, it said find biodynamic produce. And they finally had to sort of take that off of their chalkboard because there's not enough to supply a supermarket chain of that size. And so our hope, too, and our work is to train young people and have them go to farms where they would actually want to be as well. And so we do have a small land trust, too, that is beginning to hold land for biodynamic farming. And the idea is, because we are right on the cusp of probably a very large land transfer in North America. If you look at the average age of the farmer now, in some states it's almost in the 60s and 65, 55 to 65. And if you look at the children who, were the kids of those farmers, most of those are not on the farm anymore and have made their lives elsewhere. So one of the things we're going to face is what's going to happen to all of that land. And so what we want to do is to begin to hold land for agriculture that can be farmed with these methods. So that's one of the things we're trying to do.
That was my next question. Yes, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, my next comment would be that I'm also the only full-time employee of the association. So we're talking about, from the office standpoint, a smaller number of people.
My next question was what you were about to say regarding the land transfer, and that I would like to see that, and this is what I think your organization is talking about in regards to farming, is that a lot of the suburban areas that has given way to housing development were farms. And then I would like to see that either eventually be brought back to farms, or a lot of the land that is on the hinterland to be back into farming. What are the challenges of that? I know you're on the edge of talking about that.
Yes, and that is one of the major challenges, because some of the conservancy groups, and all worthy in themselves as well, that it doesn't necessarily conserve the land for agriculture. It conserves it for different different things. So what we are trying to do is specifically look at agriculture. And to deal with our modern forms, another fellow that I work with, we've been trying to develop, if you just took, unfortunately, the corporation, if you look at just a physical plant or corporate office, if you look at the in some ways, the vast amount of lawns that there are and the acreage that is actually, because it probably was farmland before it became, they all also have, a lot of them have kitchens and offer, ways of for people who work there to buy, lunches or food there too. So we are trying to develop ways too to penetrate into that world, because, after you've paved it over, it's really hard to see, how that can be undone in that sense. And that's why we're talking about such other social issues entailed in our conversation about agriculture. So we would hope, I mean, because in some of these suburbs that there are also regulations that say, for instance, that you can't have a vegetable garden in your front yard. Your front yard has to be mowed to a certain height. I mean, there are some examples of this. And some places are finally beginning to change that in cities to say that it is possible to grow food. And in fact, in the future, if, and once again, then we take on the wider question of the future of oil or the future of actually how we use the resources of the earth. And so we are going to come to a time, I believe, where the majority of our food is going to have to be grown, say, within 40 miles of a city. Well, then we are going to have to get into land use issues and the raising of food for people. So I think to a certain extent there are, you know, we have gardens that exist in Philadelphia. There are, you know, people attempting to do this on a daily basis too, to have gardens on sites within the city, to have suburbs, the common grounds, the allotments as they were certainly, and still exist in Europe. I used to have one in England as well. And so that is an issue, but it will have to, and we are attempting to tackle that from two sides. One is the land trust, and the other is training and education of young people, because we have broken that connection, too, in generational passing down of skills and information.
There are a few things I wanted to talk about. Is when you're talking about the connection and young people, is that in modern life, we're so acclimated to being in an air-conditioned building that it's rare in an urban society to toil unless you're a construction worker.
Yeah.
And that there is benefit to physical work. And there was even an essay about being a man, and that men, the masculinity of life, of modern living, is transmuted. It's a great, farming is a great way to transmute masculine energy. And that because we don't have that in urban living, we don't have that transmutation, it transmutes to violence, let's say, because the masculine energy, and we all have it, whether we're female or male, is that we have this yang energy, we have in us, and that the farming is one of the best ways, and it's a great understood way to use that energy. And another thought I had was regarding what you were saying about suburban development, and is that, and I know this has to do with land use, when we look at land, what is its best use? What for the highest good, best benefit for society, meaning not just for us right now, but for the seventh generation beyond us. What is the best use? And my opinion is that the best use of land in, away from the origins of where the city started for a farm is on the edges of the city. And it starts to kind of, it gets, in other words, urban populations get dense in the center, and then it starts to, there's a demarcation, and then there's swaths of farming around it, and that's the best use. Instead of having no or very little farming and have it populated with housing development. And that is something that is probably endless discussion. I wanted to talk about, mention that. And so what are your thoughts about that? Anything you want to say about
what I said? Yes, because that is, if you look at, and if we took, say, in the Middle Ages in Europe as an example, you did have this aspect of the cathedral in the center, you know, surrounded by the houses and the people, surrounded by the gardens, surrounded by the orchards, surrounded by the woods. and you had this sense of, well, I would want to say community, this wholeness. And what has happened is that we have really fragmented. And so I absolutely agree with that. And
yes. Mm-hmm.
So what we are trying to do, because almost everyone that I know of, too, is involved in some manner with land use, local land use issues in their own communities, because this is an incredibly local problem, and so it has to be tackled locally by individual people. However, at the same time, we have to tackle it nationally and globally, because the farm bill, you know, this idea of subsidizing ethanol production. I mean, it may sound like a great idea, you know, to not use oil from the Middle East, but the aspect of feeding corn to our cars now can change agriculture dramatically as well. So now we're seeing, what are we going to do about that? So that's beyond the GMOs and all of these issues. So
you're talking about like hyper development of anything.
Exactly.
It's almost cancerous.
You got it. And mm-hmm. cancer really is this, and you can see that in agriculture. The aspect of one person just growing so big without regard to the body of the earth and their neighbors.
This thought process of development. We think that development is about growth. And let's rephrase that, because not all growth is good. Not
mm-hmm.
all cancers, not in that sense, a cancer is something that grows, but doesn't mean that it's good for you. If we rephrase it, it could be something such as it's about cycles. And that's more in line with life. It's about
yep.
cycles. It's about expanding and contracting. It's about the yin and the yang. And going back to, in a very simple sentence, about what you said about the farming, and you said this eloquently, too, about the cathedral, is that the cathedral has a center, boundary, and gateway, the European city. What you said, the center is the cathedral. The boundaries are usually the medieval walls, the walls, and then the gateway is the entrance into that community. And I see that as a unit of what we call the modern city, and then right outside the gateway, or it would be the farms that would connect, not connect, would be the what's left over of the century boundary gateway of the city. That's
yeah.
the most ideal thing in a very simple way.
Absolutely. And once again, this would take us back, you know, to that gateway and the cancerous nature and all of these things we've been discussing. You know, we can see that humanity as such has really lost any kind of a measure to measure its actions against. So therefore, if the world is only what we perceive with our senses, then we don't have any further measure than, in a way, the sum of the parts. And so as such, then, agriculture, in the same way our society, in a way, has lost its way, agriculture has as well, quite naturally, because we have nothing to measure our actions against, that therefore you can have 2 million chickens, or you can have a feedlot of 5,000 cows, you know, and then you can have this tremendous problem of waste, you know, whereas manure should be a nutrient, not a waste. So what biodynamics is trying to do is, you know, and this is once again is from an individual standpoint, because if you look at the farm as a living and the land as a living organism, which hopefully could actually evolve into an actual agricultural individuality, we can see that through our own lives as well. And the measure that biodynamics uses is actually the human being. So when Steiner talked about the human being, he said, well, the farm, and this is hard to say, is actually a human being standing on its head. that if we look at the human being, we have a nerve sense system essentially located in our heads. We have
we're
a metabolic...
We're running out of time. We're running out of time.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. So it's the image of the human, and we wish to take that into education, into nutrition, so that, in fact, we can begin to solve the problems which you have highlighted in growing food near our cities.
So are we excited? Maybe we can send our children or ourselves go and work at a farm, biodynamic farm.
Absolutely, or any farm. You know, I mean, even
that's true.
You bet. You know, to help a chemical farmer get off that treadmill, because people are just trying to survive out there too.
I know.
So,
I guess instead of going to Nicaragua for a foreign exchange, maybe the next biggest thing is working on a farm.
No, that's marvelous. And Waldorf schools do that. And I'm not trying to just be specific either to biodynamics or to Waldorf schools, because there's a lot of really good people out there.
Well, thank you, Charles Beattie, Executive Director of the Biodynamic Farming and Garden Association. Their website is http://biodynamics.com. Thank you for being on the show.
You're welcome.
I am Emmy Louie. Have a great week, and namaste.